Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 14th of August, 1995, and in the fireside room this morning, our speaker is David Peters, and he will be doing a session entitled Birth Defects, the Case for Mandatory Genetic Screening of Prospective Parents. So let's listen in.
I really do want to practice truth in advertising today, because you will hear famous and, let's see, you will hear a very famous, oft-reprinted argument by an ethicist at the University of Virginia School of Medicine, whose name is Joseph Fletcher, who for some 20 years has been defending this proposal for mandatory genetic screening of couples who intend to have children through normal coital reproduction. The whole point here of this is to, first of all, hear him out and talk a bit about assets and liabilities of that particular proposal. Then I'd like to lead us on to what has happened. There are some things that are really chugging down the turnpike within the last 7 or 8 years, which are different ways of dealing with the problem of genetic birth defects than the one proposed by Fletcher. And these are new ventures in attempting to tinker with the actual genes that we have so as to head off at the pass before we become symptomatic for these bad genes that we can inherit. The program which has led to the very rapid discovery of various kinds of genes which control our health or illness, the project which has led to this is a 15-year international cooperative effort among molecular biologists and geneticists and so forth, which is called the Human Genome Project. Sometimes it's called the Human Genome Initiative. And the word genome refers really to that 100,000 genes which make up us distinctively as human beings and which distinguishes our genes from tulips and zebras. And the goal of this particular investigation. It started in about 1990. The funding is going to poop out in about 2005. And this international community hopes that by then they will have, to use their jargon, mapped and sequenced every one of the 100,000 some genes which make up human beings. That is, identify what it is they do, what features they control, and so forth. And the we're almost at the point now, I think, it's not hyperbole to say that the pace of discovery and being able to identify what genes do, we've almost come to the point where the jargon now is it's a gene a week. I mean, we're unmasking what genes control what. And among other things, this has made much more sophisticated now a procedure which for a long time has been called genetic screening. We used to do genetic screens of people, let's say, who were at risk for certain diseases. For example, the Ashkenazi Jews are an ethnic group that what runs in their population is a terrible childhood disease called Tay-Sachs disease. I mean, they're inordinately at risk for this particular thing. And for many years, we've been able to run blood tests and determine as to whether couples that are mating internally to that group are playing genetic roulette, And what medical people mean by playing genetic roulette is having a 1 in 4 chance or greater. This is med babble. 1 in 4 chance or greater of giving birth to a genetically defective child. But we've come, like Virginia Slim says, we've come a long ways, baby, with the intimate molecular understanding of our DNA, the substance which controls our genes. And let me just run by you some of the things we're already able to do, even though this project is in its infancy. We can, for example, take a blood sample from each one of us and run, I won't go through the technicalities of all this, but run what I'll just call in layperson's terms a gene scan. And determine, for example, things like the following. We can determine, for example, whether some of us are carrying a group of genes, which when this group works in concert with each other, predispose us to becoming symptomatic for certain forms of later health problems. Now, these are called contingency genes or predisposing genes. And the adjective is meant literally. It's not a sure thing that you will come down with this particular health problem that you have a predisposition for, but you're inclined that direction if other factors come into play, environmental, other genes. We can, for example, already tell from a blood sample as to whether, for example, you have a set of genes which predisposes you to what is called hypercholesterolemia. That is, whether you're one of these unfortunate beings that will run the cholesterol thing off the scale because your body, you know, produces so much of it. We can tell whether you're already inclined toward that because of your genes. And of course, like taking a little toe pricks, you know, with kids in a hospital to determine whether they, you know, have the gene for phenylketonuria, we can then move in. You know, if you do have a predisposition to high cholesterol, we can prevent that the symptoms from coming about by monitoring your diet and you know, taking various cholesterol medications and so forth. Likewise, a recent breakthrough just within the past years is that we have found what appears to be a set of genes which, working in concert, predispose people to osteoporosis. Well, obviously, for those of us who are not over the hill, if a child does display this particular gene, there are a lot of things that one can do in terms of additional calcium intake early on and so forth. Other things we can do on these predisposing genes, and it's become very controversial, you can figure this out, is that we're also able, for a certain number of diseases, we're able to tell whether you're carrying certain genes which predispose you to certain kind of health problems. If your genes meet certain work sites that have certain factors or agents in them, maybe certain kinds of fumes, chemical fumes, or fibers in the air, certain kinds of radiation, and so forth. If you have these predisposing genes and you propose to work at a work site that has these triggering other things, then you're going to be in big time trouble. And not surprisingly, employers who typically pick up your healthcare tab are very interested in finding out whether you're a ticking time bomb, whether your genes and the features of the work site are really a mismatch. Employers would like, legally, to have the legal freedom to refuse to hire an otherwise qualified person who, through a gene scan, shows that he or she is predisposed to some sort of worksite illness because of the genes. I mean, you could see why they want to do that, because most of these insurance policies are experience rated, right? And depending on the claims you have during a certain year, we'll decide what premium as a group you're going to pay for the next year. So that's one thing that we've unmasked, are what are called contingency genes or predisposing genes, which work in concert with other things such that you can deal with these by heading off the past these other things. But we have also already made progress in discovering, for example, certain kinds of genes. Sometimes in biological speak, they're called autosomal dominant genes. I'm just going to call them strongly determinative genes. And they're meant to be a contrast to these predisposing genes. Huntington's chorea. First of all, you all know that if you are a child of a union where one of the parents has got Huntington's chorea, you are at 50% risk of carrying the gene. Now, Huntington's chorea is a disease. We know this genetically. If you've got the Huntington's gene, this is a one gene disease. Most of the diseases that we know of are typically linked to multiple genes working as a group. Very few genetic disorders are based upon a single gene. But Huntington's chorea is a genetic defect which we can now tell whether you carry the Huntington's gene. And if you have it, you will come down with Huntington's chorea, a terrible neurodegenerative disease, if you live long enough. Guaranteed. Now, this is a very interesting, brave new world, because if you're a child of a union where one of the your mom or dad have had Huntington's chorea, you know that you're at 50% risk. You can now find out whether you carry the gene, whether that is your fate, or whether you're free of it. And one of the interesting things is, would you go to a genetic lab to find out? Because there's no cure. There is no cure. It's a fascinating circumstance where you can know whether you're headed toward this terrible circumstance, but there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, would you choose to know in a situation like this? But we can reveal that now for Huntington's chorea and some other single gene health problems. Of course, a genetic scan can also determine as to whether you merely carry genes for certain genetic disorders. And if you are, let me just name some diseases. Sickle cell anemia, which runs basically within the black population. Cystic fibrosis. Lesch-Nihan disease, Tay-Sachs disease, which we talked about with the Jews and so forth. These are all single, these are our genes that a child has to get in a double dose. It's got to get one of these bad genes from mom and pop. You have to have a double whammy of it, sort of like the genes for blue eyes. I mean, you got to have them both or it's not going to exhibit itself. But see, you can be a carrier of a single gene for this, but not be affected symptomatically. I mean, you can carry the cystic fibrosis gene, you can carry the sickle cell gene, yet it not be, it will not afflict you. But you see, now what comes into view is the health of your children. Because if you've got two partners, each of which carry the gene, there's a 1 in 4 chance, you see, of a child getting, a child of yours getting the gene in a double dose and being afflicted with it. So we can determine carrier status now for various kinds of diseases.
Kim, I'm just curious because we have a family that we know that had a child die of diabetes, child die of cystic fibrosis, another one that is medically ill. Manic depressive.
Yeah,
they had three kids, and not one of them was normal.
What I can tell you is that the somewhere in literature I've got here, they've where we are in the manic depressive. This is, I mean, these people that do this stuff talk about obtaining a marker. This is again technical talk. a marker for a particular disease. Now all that means is that those who are trying to figure out on which chromosome this defective gene falls, that we've ambushed the chromosome, and internal into the topography of the chromosome, we've now eliminated a host of other things, and we think we got the zone. We got the sucker ambushed, but we haven't got the exact gene yet, but we know it's in there somewhere. Now, I think with respect to manic depressive, that's where we're at.
Family had all these genes, both parents did, and each time they gave one of those Zappos to one of their children.
Did they ever have a genetic screening test? This is what we need to talk about now. Because I gave you a little handout there. We're going to talk about really three different ways of trying to address the problem of genetic defects. And the first is my attempt to summarize an argument run by Joe Fletcher at the University of Virginia. What I try to do, I mean, he's written a lot on this, and my students oftentimes, what I make them do is after they've read a 15-page article or something, I say, you got to type out in not more than one page the major plot line of this particular argument. If you can't figure out what the bottom line is and what the major premises are that get you there, then you don't understand it. So I try and hold myself to this kind of a thing. I don't want to really read this at you. I hate to be read at. Let's see, without throwing the baby out with the bathwater, what I can summarize what Joe Fletcher is up to. Fletcher, now I'm really telescoping this argument, just leaving out tons, okay? But the general drift of it is that he says, and he's writing this maybe 15 years ago, and so there's a sense in which everything he says has a lot more zap and smack now, given the incredible technological developments that we've gone. But he says, look, he tells us he's dealing from a utilitarian deck as far as ethics go. You know a utilitarian when you run into one, because they say there is only one moral rule, that's all you need to do ethics. And you and I have cut our teeth on it since we were wee tots. And the principle of utility runs this way. I'll give you the short form, then the long form. Short form is, always pick that action from the available alternatives which does the greatest good of the greatest number. I mean, you know, that's the familiar. Always pick that action from the range of alternatives which has the fattest chance of generating the greatest amount of happiness, greatest balance of happiness or unhappiness across the whole field of affected parks.
How do you measure happiness?
I don't want to get into that because Jeremy Bentham, the founding father of this, thought you could do this. He thought you could quantify what I'll call jolly points and bummer points. You know, we had five pain points and, you know, 10. That's one of those things that we could spend a week on, and we do in our class.
The extrapolation of this position leads one to the conclusion that we can have a class of people in our society who are breeders, a class of people who are workers, and a class of people who are eliminated. Adolf Hitler started with a similar premise, killed 6 million Jews, and we have data to suggest that the extrapolation is not healthy for our society. Would it be that our society were filled with people who were good and altruistic? That might work. Unfortunately, we have few millennia of history to show us that we have bad people among us who would take this and use it to the poorness of our society. And when one includes that possibility in determining the total happiness, they include the pain brought to us by Adolf Hitler. Using the same premise, I submit that you can throw it all out.
Well, let me just, this is a mere aside because I want to get let Joe make his case here. You're quite right. I think that utilitarianism, here's the funny fact about utilitarianism. I'm really convinced of this. I can't live with it, but I can't live without it. Because utilitarianism says, I can't tell you whether a given act is right or wrong until I take time out and explore all the consequences which is likely to have across the field of affected parties. I mean, you can't just ask me, is this right or wrong? I got to go on my consequence analysis, and I got to do that for every alternative.
It's mathematically impossible to do.
Right. There are all kinds of problems with it. But I'm telling you that the economic analog of utilitarianism, that is, when utilitarianism metamorphoses in The Economist, what you end up with is what is called cost-benefit analysis, and the criterion of efficiency, which says that the right way to use a resource is that way which satisfies the most people's preferences, okay? And it's a criterion of efficiency, and you're always trying to get what I'll call the biggest bang for the buck, right? I mean, you should see that the trickle-down effect of utilitarianism when it invades economics is the criterion of efficiency. How can we do the most with the least? And so Fletcher says, this is where I'm starting. He points out, let's just get through the argument, and then we'll
no, I'll rip it to shreds.
Okay? Anyway, he starts off by saying, look, it used to be the case that couples, when they procreated, they really had no way of knowing, unless you come from a family at great risk, like Huntington's, Korea, right? But most of us had no way of knowing whether we were playing genetic roulette. I mean, this was all acts of fate, and if we gave birth to a defective child or something of this sort, well, it was an act of God. Fletcher says that's all changed. We now can know, in a great many cases, as to whether prior to conception a child is playing, or a couple is playing genetic roulette. He thinks, and he obviously thinks there's something like a technological imperative. If we can know, if couples can know that they are at significant risk, greater than 1 in 4 chance, if the technology is there to make this revelation to you, and you simply say, I'd really rather not know, I think I'll just go ahead and wing it, and we'll see what comes to pass. What Fletcher is pointing out is that you're going to have the needless birth of genetically defective children that almost invariably are going to become wards of the state. All of us as taxpayers are going to have to pay for the extravagant prices for this. And since money doesn't grow on trees, isn't it both economically and if we can prevent harm, serious harm, and what he keeps thumping on is that he thinks there's no controversy, that there is a certain set of horrible, horrible childhood diseases. I mean, I've named some of them. Lesch-Nyhan's disease and spina bifida, and Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, and all this kind of stuff. And Fletcher parades in front of us and dares us to say, well, I don't see what's so wrong about that. I mean, these are horrible diseases. And in many cases, we can know whether a couple is at risk to give birth to a child like this.
So that bad, isn't 1 out of 4 kind of bad odds? I mean, you want to be 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 100,000.
Well, okay, now, but let's just take time out. That's rather interesting because my students shoot back at me and say, that's how medical people speak. 1 in 4 chance of giving birth to a defective child. And some of my students say, but geez, if I was Jimmy the Greek, the odds maker in Vegas, I'd say, but that's a 3 out of 4 chance of giving birth to a normal child. I mean, Jimmy would take those odds any day, so why should we worry about a 1 in 4 chance?
But if you have 4 children.
Well, right. This is where it plots against the thicken or sicken here. Well, let me just finish the argument, and then, you know, we've got to get Joe's thing in court. So Joe simply says, we are talking about preventable, horrible diseases, which invariably bleed the tax coffers. All of us take the hit. Needlessly, we're talking about the perpetration of needless harm, Because every dollar spent, hundreds of thousands often per year, on some of these genetically defective children. Now, we're not just talking about dollars. We're talking about the pain and suffering of these kids, too, which is here and now. I mean, we're not just worried about money. We're talking about bringing into the world, needlessly, a sufferer. And that ought to grab you morally. The question, how dare you, if the technology is here, and we can determine this, then he thinks there's a moral pressure upon every person to undergo a gene scan prior to procreating to determine as to whether they're playing genetic roulette or not. Now, he says, we could depend on the sheer goodwill of people and simply say, we exhort you to undergo a gene scan to find out whether you and your mate are a couple at risk. But he says, you know, most people don't have a sense of civil duty enough to have them, and to be grabbed by that. And so he says, if we could depend on people's altruism and coming out of the woodwork and say, here am I, Lord, you know, give me a gene scan because I don't want to bring into the world a sufferer. I don't want to bring into the world somebody that's going to draw down on the public resources. So he thinks probably we're going to have to make it mandatory. How does he propose? What is the proposal? Well, he seriously proposes that every child that is born in a hospital, we're already doing this. We do a little heel prick for phenylketonuria, for maple syrup urine disease, and so forth. I mean, we just carry this on, and we take a little blood sample, and we run a gene scan, and put all that data into a central registry. Okay? And then what happens is that when you and your mate-to-be come and apply for a marriage license, we put the data, the genetic data from you two, into a computer, and the computer spits out as to whether or not you're at genetic risk. Okay? He doesn't think that this is any more violation of privacy than when Nancy and I got married. We had to take a Rh compatibility blood test. I mean, I didn't say boo about that. I didn't find that. But of course, the children's health, future children's health, are exactly at risk there. Are you against what physicians call contact tracing? I mean, if you show up and you have some sort of venereal disease, the first thing that your physician is going to say is, I want to know who you've been sleeping with. You say, well, that's my business. And he'll say, I'm sorry, not anymore. We're already in this business. And we have a major public health problem here.
What do you do when they're dating
someone? Well, if they test positive?
No. Okay. You're not going to use the data until they're old enough to get married.
Okay, well, we can come back to that. I mean, I thought the question was, well, what does he recommend if the couple proves to be positive? I mean, is he to simply say, well, what are you going to do? No? I mean, you can't stop there once you're chugging down. Mm-hmm. The next thing is he says, well, what he frankly recommends, he's writing in a time, I can't confirm this, but he tells us that in Denmark, they got to get tough policy on this. That they're into this business, and if a couple proves to be at risk, one or both of them have to be sterilized. Now, I mean, it doesn't park them off from having kids. They can adopt. We can have in vitro fertilization, surrogate parenting. I mean, you don't have to go childless. So he frankly thinks that to just wing it when the technology is there and not make it mandatory is frankly an antisocial act.
Do you trust the technology for starters?
Well, you can always worry about it's reliable and...
Take one of the genetic diseases, which is manic depressive syndrome. There are an awful lot of artists, authors, and musicians that have, in the past have had that. If they had been crossed off early in their life or before their life, we never would have had them.
I like Greg, but it doesn't mean that because you're a manic depressive that you would make a better musician. There's no correlation.
No, it just says that there are some aspects of manic depression that we don't like. There are others that we value. And we're kind of overlooking some of those in the equation.
Two things. One, you talk about this person with defects. you are a person with defects. You got gray hair prematurely, and your vision deteriorated 2 years faster than the norm. Therefore, you shouldn't have been born, and this might have been known. Where do you draw the line?
Okay, let's linger with, see, the problem with this issue that we're talking about is you can't just talk about one thing, okay? I mean, it's like the impossibility of going to driving school where the guy says, now today we're going to work on the accelerator pedal and tomorrow the brake. I mean, you can't learn to drive like that. You got to do everything at once. Here comes a question already, which I thought was going to be a spin-off once we got talking about new ways of dealing with genetic defects after the fact. You know, various forms of doing therapy on genes. I thought it would explode up. But what Art is raising here is, and you might as well back it up to the screening level. If you're going to screen for certain diseases, and if later on, if we get on to talking about how you could tinker with human genes so as to change bad genes into good ones, one of the things is, isn't our conceptual issue here, is how you know a disease or a defect.
Yes.
How do you draw
now,
a line?
What is a defect?
Pardon?
What is a defect? Is being over 6 feet tall a defect?
That's the utility definition.
How so?
Well, a gene defect would be that gene that doesn't cause the greatest good for the greatest number.
Okay. How about this? Let's say that something is a defect if in some way it significantly intrudes on a person's ability to live a normal life.
Well, we're all going to die sometime.
That will lead you to eliminating African Americans from this country if you take statistics.
Why?
Because look at the income, look at the education level. You say this statistically is not as good as this, therefore we should eliminate it.
I disagree with this analysis because I think the fact of the impoverishment of the blacks is probably not genetically based.
Hey, we're just looking utilitarian, just at the facts. Just at the facts.
I will concede that the biggest problem that utilitarianism has, one of many, but the big problem for me, is that you can right and left justify things as the right thing to do public policy-wise on the ground of the greatest good of the greatest number, and yet that not pass the criterion of justice.
Yeah,
you could justify slaveholding.
Building bombers and take care of your people, that's where justice comes in.
Okay, let's
I think we need to narrow back down to what he is addressing here is life-impairing diseases. I'm a pediatric nurse who works with children that suffer these afflictions, kids that are ventilator dependent all their lives. I think the general public doesn't see the extent that the children suffer or the care that the parents have, you know, the obligation that parents have towards these children. We're not talking premature aging or anything else. We're talking very specific diseases.
I'm not talking theoretical. My son has a genetic abnormality. I know something of this topic. I have lived it for the last 14 years.
But he's a functional child in society.
And I know many who are not.
That.
Yeah.
And I know many who are not.
Well, I think before we go to the level of including all these other categories, we need to see. Now, this is what we're studying today. What he's saying is there's a very specific group that is genetically detectable. That's what we're talking about.
Okay. Just to pick up your thing here. Look, let's just concede at the outset. Just 3 points. Bing, bing, bing. Let's concede at the outset that the notion of defect or disease is vague. And what I mean by that is you can't draw bright lines to say, you know, here's where we've moved from a mere cultural inconvenience, small-breastedness or a big nose or baldness, and now we're into the, I mean, it's like asking, how many hairs does somebody have to lose before they're bald? I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's vague. I mean, Telly Savalas is bald and Gene Shalit is not bald. I mean, are clear cases. I mean, it's not a wasteful term, you know. And so I think you're right that what he's focusing on is what he thinks are model cases of uncontroversially terrible diseases. And if we can head off at the pass these kinds of things, that's what he's interested in. Now, maybe way down the pipe, we may be worried about whether an IQ of 70 whether homosexual disposition, which appears to be genetically based, is a defect. You see, it's going to come, but simply because far on the other side of the mountain we're going to encounter these problems doesn't mean that we've dealt a lethal blow to the proposal.
Right, it's not even saying Down syndrome is something that's going to be considered, because a Down syndrome child can live a very functional,
exactly,
healthy life.
I mean, all genetic defects are not created equal.
No, these are devastating, deadly. Child's going to die, doesn't have a really normal kind of life. I mean, I definitely separate them into a different category personally, because I've seen the effects. And a lot of you have too. I'm just saying, let's focus on the issue, because I'm curious to see where this has gone.
Any other comments?
How do we define suffering? I mean, you see kids that, in your definition, are suffering, but how do you know what is happening between that child and that family, what that child's illness is bringing to the family, what that child's strength, what that child's life, that child's life is bringing? I mean, we can't define suffering. I mean, suffering for some people is joy. Suffering is change. Suffering is bringing us to a new level of appreciation of life in some cases. And so, I mean, that idea of suffering is very, very negative, whereas a Christian, suffering can be a very positive thing in the lives of many people, okay?
Well, that's
really one thing. I mean, the other thing is, it's like a slap in the face of God, in God's face, to not rely on your faith in Him to give you children, provide you with children that will enhance the family, enhance God's purpose in the world. And we don't always know what that is. And the thought of being manipulative of that is absolutely hypocritical.
Well, let me respond to that. There's a standard objection to everything we're talking about here, and you can see if we ever got into these other ways of dealing with these, that boy, now the problem is there big time. Somebody says, that's just plain God. Okay, that's the way it comes out. My response to this is, I'm sorry, but we're already in that business. All of medicine is a gigantic enterprise of plain God. I mean, we cure people, we delimit the amount of pain that people will have. I mean, are we mucking up God's plan?
Probably.
See? I mean, we're already in this business, and if you have a plain God problem, then we better abandon medicine.
No, because we're already there. Every time we play God on the opposite end of the spectrum is an absolute, unexplainable healing or something that absolutely goes against our playing God, so that we are told that, you know, things are going to happen because God can perform miracles. Things are going to happen just exactly when doctors and nurses can't explain them. So for every time we play God, there's a miracle on the other end of Mitchell.
But this is pre-abortion. I mean, to me, this is...
See, we're not talking about kids that are already here and asking whether, as parents of these tragic kids, we're growing somehow by having to live with this tragedy. We're not asking whether the child who's already here should have the choice or anything. We're talking about not even producing these kids. I mean, we're just talking about not even bringing them into the world.
The breeding group. We'll have the children. The breeding group.
The alphas.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, perhaps, who are we to second guess what God is deciding for us? And perhaps God has provided us with medicine and technology 50 years ago that we weren't able to handle. And now we are able to handle it, and He has given us the means to use that, and perhaps it's just another part of God's plan. You know, if we just throw it out and say, well, we're playing God, and that's just as hypocritical to me.
Yeah.
Well, I, as a school teacher, we're getting a lot of drug babies. We're getting babies where parents have been on some kind of drug when they have conceived, and these children are coming through school, and they're very hard to teach. And I would look, and that's not, I don't think God gave the drugs to these kids so that they could take them to have these children that are not going to be the fullness that they could be if they were conceived, you know, without the drugs. And this is an issue that really is something that's going to have to come through, because we're killing the generation coming up. It's not as healthy as the generation that was before it.
Okay, and an interesting speculative question is,
the more the kids like me, the better he is.
No.
That's an outside influence that's changed. And
right.
You know, we're talking about
the genetic hardwiring of people and how we influence that, not whether we take drugs to affect the...
But if you look at the billions of dollars that it's going to take to implement this program, I know something about computers, I know something about chemistry, I know something about biology, you're talking about billions of dollars. My argument is, forgetting what you do to the political arena to pull it off, why not take those billions of dollars, coupled with a few billions of dollars for not building bombers, and put it together in programs to work with these people so that they're not on drugs when they're conceiving babies? That would be a more productive implementation of my tax dollars.
How about this, Art? I mean, let's just play hardball, okay? One interesting wrinkle, which has come down the pike since Fletcher wrote this article eons ago, you know, is this. I've talked to some obstetricians and gynecologists recently, and they tell me that it'll probably be another 6 or 7 years, maybe a decade, but no more than that, before the various sterilization procedures available, both vasectomies and tubal ligations, are reversible. Okay, right now it's experimental. And I don't know, maybe we got a 60% success rate or something, but like taking out tonsils, we're going to get better and better in terms of the reversibility of sterilization procedures. Uh-huh. What would you think about this particular proposal? That, Newt Gingrich is going zonks, about a welfare program and teenage pregnancies and so forth. I don't know whether medically we can do this, but this is fantasized. So let's just suppose that, you know, in the way now we routinely circumcise boys when they come in, I guess that used to be a health problem, and nobody quite understands why we're doing this. It's like, once a C-section, always a C-section, and nobody quite understands, you know, you get trapped by mere history. But let's just suppose that we could do a tubal on a very young infant, or a vasectomy. Now, understand it, this is reversible.
100% reversible.
Okay. Now, would this be wrong? Now, you see, what you're into here is that it would be impossible for kids to pump out babies, druggies, you know, at the age of 14, or welfare mothers already got two kids. That the undoing would have to be licensed by the state at such time that...
Who gets to decide?
Huh?
Who gets to decide?
Well, we're already deciding who gets welfare. We're already in that business.
How about a
dental repair shot? What if the rules change, you know? You had your baby, let your baby be fixed like that, and then the rules become stricter. Isn't that taking the absolute freedom away from that?
Not
child?
Absolute. You still can, I mean, assuming it can be reversed, we still have this.
Yeah, but what if then the general public's opinion is it shouldn't be reversed for anybody? You know, it could happen because...
Well. We'd have to know what the reasons are. I mean, I take it that Homo sapiens is going to be in dire straits if nobody's reproducing. I mean, I'm not sure we go that far.
But the population is, and we had a big population thing Saturday, that our population, you know, going out of the world.
Going out of the world.
Well, too many children being born by yuppies and people under 18.
Well, that's sort of an aside, but I'm telling you, I've got a friend down in the welfare division in Madison, Wisconsin, he tells me that bathroom talks about stuff like this. And they're starting to talk about with respect to welfare mothers. If they already got two kids, what New Jersey's done is simply say, if you got three kids, we're not giving you one more penny. You're still going to get, you know, and we thought, oh, well, now we're going to get tough and they will start being more disciplined. But you can really solve the problem with a reversible tool right there. Okay? And at such time that you can show us that you can, I mean, like when you go to adopt, gee, it's the most privacy-invading thing in the world, everything they want to know about you, including your IRS form and whether you can actually, you know, fund a child like this. And so this is bathroom talk down in Madison. I mean, but why not push it back one step further, namely to infancy? Well, this is not... You know, really on the topic
again,
of...
Again, Adolf Hitler had a plan similar to this. His goal was the same.
You mean to have a pure race?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's what you're talking
well,
about.
Well, are we in the same league here? We're simply asking for a human gene pool in which we have less and less frequency of certain...
No.
Certain
well, you're opening Genie's bottle, and you know what's two hills away, and you're saying, let's ignore that. And I'm saying,
well, this is what's called a slippery slope argument.
Yes, it is.
The banana peel argument, opening wedge, camel's head under the tent argument. And what one, I mean, the problem I have, Art, with all this is that I don't care what public policy that you propose to me. It has something to do with parking meters. If I let my imagination run, I can come up with just horrible scenarios of we're going to go to hell in a handbasket with it. I mean, just let my creativity go. But the proper question is, do you have any evidence, Peters, any precedent, you know, on the basis of which you can argue for this? Anybody can dream up these incredible, bizarre fantasies of what's going to happen. The question is it merely in your mind?
The first people Adolf Hitler had killed were those with mental retardation.
Yeah, but Art, look. Let me counter. Let me argue against myself. Somebody may say, look, in the United States, we're not made of the stuff that the Germans were. Okay, it could never happen here. Okay. Now, first of all, if I say, look,
we're not. Do you have any German blood in you, please?
I might say, look, we're just not cut from that. What I would then, I'm going to argue against myself, but I would then say, yeah, well, you tell that story to people of Japanese ancestry.
Yes.
Exactly.
Just once, you tell it. We're not the kind of people to put people in concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Ooh, now it's starting to get hot. But let me fight a historical example with a historical example, because the question is, could it happen here? Back in the 20s, there was a number of states that started to get on the bandwagon with respect to compulsory sterilization of people who, this is old talk, feeble-minded. I mean, there were guys like Benny on L.A. Law, you know, that had some sort of genetic...
They did sterilizations like that in the state of Oregon up to the year 1960-1961.
That's not true. I just can't believe that, because the figures that I saw here is that we had as many as 21 states that had mandatory sterilization laws. And the question is, oh my God, where are we going to go from here? I mean, we're going to go right to Hitlerian Germany. What actually happened? The report that I read recently is that most of these laws were repealed, and the laws, the states in which there is a law, it's never been enforced. I mean, we just backed away. We made it into voluntary. Now, that's just a point to ponder with respect to the question as to whether we're of the same stock as the Gestapo. I mean, I'm not sure it is.
Well, isn't it true now that parents that already have one genetically defective child of this league, they do, I don't know if it's mandatory, but at least I know voluntarily, they do have a genetic screen and they find out what their odds are.
After the fact.
That's something I guess I feel like I can get behind a little more than this everyone needs to do it. Just because
it might not be... What is your first name?
Betsy.
It might not, Betsy, be cost effective. I mean, it costs so much that the... I mean, it's like testing everybody for like heart disease or something. I mean, it may cost more than the total amount that might be required to cure somebody after the fact. I mean, you know, then Fletcher would say, well, I'm a utilitarian. I'm not for that. I mean, when the costs exceed the benefits, then I'm backing down. I mean, he would simply hide behind his...
It seems like then you're taking the highest risk groups and still allowing them the freedom of choice, you know, ignoring the price tag. But still, you know, ethically and morally, they can say, we knew, we chose, we have, you know. But again, you're talking about, you know, a small percentage of the population, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
There are lots of different interesting roads that the Human Genome Project can lead us down. I think another interesting one is who has access to this information.
Yes.
and who... says that you should have this testing done. Right now, a lot of insurance companies mandate that you have to have an electrocardiogram or your cholesterol or family history or whatever. Who's to say that with all the money that insurance companies have, will come in and do saliva testing for genetic screening or even a blood, you know, finger stick for genetic screening, and then risk categorize you what your insurance rates are going to be, or they won't insure you at all.
Well, right now, what is your first name?
Chris.
Chris? My understanding, Chris, I mean, I turn my kids loose on this public policy issue as it bears upon insurance in one of the classes here. And here's the way I think things are, almost in any jurisdiction. State fair employment laws prohibit any employer from refusing to hire an otherwise qualified person who has a handicap.
Americans with Disabilities Act.
An American with disability. I mean, if somebody come in and can program that computer, but they happen to have some disability of some sort, you can't just simply say, next, you know, I'm looking for somebody without a disability. I mean, that it becomes illegal.
I don't know how many firemen are on wheelchairs. There are ways of getting around the rules.
But you also have to be careful that the ADA is already under severe attack in Congress by Newt Gingrich. They want to throw it out.
See the devil in disguise.
Well, it's up for us. But all I'm saying, now, to just cast it in the insurance thing, if you come birthed into the world with one of these genetic defects, and let's just take Huntington's chorea or something that you will get if you live long enough, you're a ticking time bomb, I could see some insurance company say, you know what you got? You got a pre-existing condition.
Right. Yes.
Geez, I never thought of it that way, but I guess that's what I have. It just hasn't become symptomatic yet, and you're quite right. And we'll simply say, they're going to simply say, really rather not insure you. I mean, we're not insuring. I mean, it's like somebody coming in to an insurance office and say, hey, you see that burning building across the street? I own that. Could I get some fire insurance? I mean, insurance companies are not interested in selling insurance to sure thing draws on the insurance pool. Now, if insurance companies can find out even whether you've got these contingency genes toward hypercholesterolemia or heart disease and so forth, they're going to simply say, I'm not interested. Or we're going to require you to pay a premium at about 225% of what the normal person, which is unaffordable. You're going to say, well, I guess I'll go without insurance. Then you come down with a problem. You go to the hospital, and you're administered to, and the hospital takes the hit, and then, of course, the hospital passes all these charges on to the other patients. You know, it's like a marshmallow. You punch one end, it comes out in the other. I mean, you never really get it.
But what happens when you max out your $2 million policy, which happens all the time with these kids, whether they're on campus or whatever, when they max out, they want to drop them. No one else wants to.
Oh, exactly. Well, you're quite right. I mean, you people are very alert to see the... Mm-hmm. This is a nest. This is a nest of issues, like in ecology. You can't do one thing. Mm-hmm. Somehow, if we're going to make an intelligent decision, we got to get all this stuff in the pocket. Anybody know what time it is?
Half past something.
Yeah, quarter to one.
Okay, I've got... Actually, I'm on a cameo appearance here. I'm on dish duty over here. Hour out, I have to go put my apron on to get back.
Well, also people with money. There's a new gene, I don't know, it's from the genome thing, where they can take a $250 a whap, and it can make them younger. It can improve their internalness so that they are, I mean, more improved people.
That's
on
TV. Oil.
No, it's a doctor with three. It's $250.
I thought it was
Geritol. No. a talk is a, but you do that once a week. You have to be very rich to take that pill. No. It was just on the news last week.
Step right up, ladies and gentlemen.
Where can I get this? I mean, I don't see what's bad about
the hell of babies.
But you have to be very rich to do something.
Well, let's hear.
I just want to tell you, my brother was very much Hitler idea that okay, these should be cut from society. If there's a gene in your family that you will have retardation or something. He married a lady that has Huntington's. He has four daughters. Now his attitude has changed.
That's right. When it roosts on your shoulder, it looks different.
He was Hitlerian before he had the daughters, and now he's glad he has these daughters that are at risk.
Wouldn't you be?
He's a humanist now.
Does he want his daughters to not have children? Does he want them to have the tests? Or would he have
He must be cut from different stock than I am, and I think
he can't make that decision.
That I would just feel an incredible case of the guilt for knowing that even unwittingly, I could exonerate myself. I didn't know. But here I have four children here, and the probabilities are way up there that they're going to suffer this terrible neurodegenerative disease. I mean, I think I would feel awful.
I go to see my sister-in-law, and there's a board of Huntington's. And it's one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Well, I know, that's Fletcher's point. If we can prevent this, why are we just sitting there saying, oh, hit me,
But if it's you, you don't want to say, I'm not going to have any more children, I'm not going to have any more grandchildren, they can't adopt.
I might.
You can't. If the history, you're not going to let
them
adopt.
Well, I thought you said have any more children.
Right.
I mean,
they can't adopt because our society won't let them adopt if they're going to look at a parent that's disabled.
Yeah, of course, it's usually 40s and 50s, isn't that the onset of Huntington's?
Her sister had it and was dead before she was 40.
Really?
Mm. There was five in her family and three have so far.
The actual disease?
Yeah, well, the question is, are your children off and running on their own power but by then such that they don't need the day-to-day care?
Well, that's true, but they go ahead and have the test. One out of the four has had the test.
Are you talking about the daughters?
They have the factor, they have the disease. Are they actively now have the disease?
My sister-in-law does. One's had the test, and she knows she has a 90% chance she won't have. But she had a child before that.
You mean she was shown to be negative?
Negative.
On
the other three have never had the test.
But
I can understand that because, here's a phenomenal thing about Huntington's. Now, just muse on this for a minute. You can say, well, of course that would be true. We already know prior to this genetic revelation where I can tell you definitely where you carried Huntington's disease. But before we were able to do this, all I knew is that I was at 50% risk. Even then, before we knew, some people who were so scared of their fate would commit suicide. Now, would you be surprised to know that psychiatrically, a preponderant number of people that go and get the test and the lab says you're positive for it, does it surprise you that a preponderant group of these people start contemplating suicide? I mean, it's true. Now, what is the psychiatrist supposed to say? Well, you have no just reason to fear? Oh, come on. I mean, I don't know what I would say if I was in a counseling position.